I'm Brandi Cruz, coming up today on Undivided. Who, if anyone, should be responsible for slowing the spread of misinformation on social media? Plus, Bob Ferguson seems very, very worried about his record on public safety. And efforts to paint serial squatters as the victims will not work. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided on this Monday. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Woo, Nicole and I had a busy few days off. Technically, we're supposed to have three-day weekends, and we kind of never do. Mm-hmm. Nicole's like, yeah, we don't. We should talk about that. We had a lot. We always try to get out and about and meet people. I was at, so Thursday after the show, we were honored to participate in the annual Seattle Police Foundation Award Ceremony, which is just an opportunity to honor men and women of the Seattle Police Department who go above and beyond the call of duty. And so we were able to show our support for a police department that doesn't get enough of it. But it was also nice because, like, Deputy Mayor Tim Burgess was there, Todd Lywicki was there, and who else? Sarah Nelson was there, Tanya Wu, the council members, and they were there in support of the police, which is like, I know that's not asking a lot, but it felt like a nice change of pace to have a room full of people who recognize the difficult work the men and women of the Seattle Police Department are doing. So it was an honor to participate in that. And then we went up to, I was a keynote speaker at the Whatcom County Lincoln Day dinner, and me, I'm sitting there, you know, Friday night, like, oh, I'm going to go to Whatcom County tomorrow. And I made an offer to go put, because while I was up there, we were staying in Ferndale. What is the casino we stayed at? The Silver Reef.
Yes.
I lost some money on blackjack. That's fine. But I was like, you know what? No idle hands when everything's at stake. So I volunteered on social media. I said, hey, if you live in the Ferndale area, I will personally on Sunday morning come put a Dave Reichert for governor yard sign in your yard. And I'm thinking, like, five people will be, it's Ferndale. And I was like, oh, five people will ask me to do it.
You were under some misconception that there aren't that many people up there.
Well,
or something.
It's not like Seattle. I'm just saying that I thought, like, five or ten or something. Well, that was a mistake. Not a mistake. I had a ton of fun. But I thought it would take 2 hours. And it took about 5 to 6 hours. Uh-huh. I refused to let Nicole participate because she's working too much. So I took Senator Simon Sefcik out with me and Daryl from the podcast. And we went door to door, yard to yard. We were in Ferndale. I even met a woman out. She lived on Lummi Island.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, love you, but I can't come to the island. But if you ferry on over, I'll meet you at the ferry terminal. And that was our first stop, 10:08 a.m., ferry came in, met her there, super nice, gave her sign. She headed back to the ferry, and then we were everywhere. We were Ferndale, we were Everson, we were Bellingham. It was great.
Oh, yeah, you thought, I mean, people said Ferndale area. Everson is quite far away from Ferndale, really. But, yeah, you guys did it.
We did do it. It was good. Yeah. So it was a lot of fun, and I was really glad that we offered. I mean, it took, you know, much longer than I had anticipated, but I loved every second of it.
I do think that people underestimate how important signs like that are, because yes, you really have to get the name recognition. You have to let people know you're not alone when you're voting for a Republican, heaven forbid. And I just think it's a good, you know, support system that you create.
Well, there were a few people who were like, can I get an extra sign? Because I think it'll probably get stolen. I'm like, sure. Which was a little bit sad, but it was really, really fun. So it was a pleasure to meet so many of you. Maybe we'll do that again. Nicole didn't participate because I literally refused to allow her. And she said she had FOMO, but she did create, because you're from that area, so she created a little map with how to most effectively utilize our time.
Right.
And we just had a blast. And that was the first time Daryl got a chance to really come out and do something with the podcast.
Right.
He lives up in Bellingham.
With you.
And yeah, it was security kind of situation, but we didn't need any because everyone was super nice and awesome. So I had a heck of a good time, and I'll post some pictures on social media. All right. Speaking of Dave Reichert and his, well, what do I want to call it? I think it's still a long shot. Okay. But I'm very optimistic that this is the year that Dave Reichert can become governor. Now, he has a formidable opponent. Bob Ferguson is a formidable opponent. Anyone who doesn't believe that is just either not paying attention or they got their head in the clouds and it's a little bit of wishful thinking. So Bob Ferguson, though, I think he's seen some polling that we have not seen. I think they have some internal polling that says that public safety is an issue that is looking very, very bad for his campaign, and specifically his record on public safety as the attorney general for 12 years. And all of a sudden, Bob is only tweeting and only talking about public safety. So you remember on the show last week, we played clips of an interview he did with King 5. And the whole intent of this King 5 interview was to reveal his plan on public safety. So we counted, since that interview came out, Bob has posted 10 times on his X account. 9 of them have been about his public safety plan. He's got surrogates tweeting about, oh, Bob's, we're all in for Bob and his public safety plan. He's retweeting people, you know, friends of his and media talking about his public safety plan and what he's going to do to increase law enforcement staffing, what he's going to do to help with the drug crisis, all of this stuff. And I'm like, that is a desperate man. I don't know how you can look at it any other way, because you've got Dave Reichert, who obviously is, people are going to believe can handle the public safety crisis better, not just because he is a former sheriff, but because he has throughout his entire career talked about the importance of public safety and fought for public safety. Bob Ferguson, on the other hand, has said nothing at times where it really mattered and really could have made a difference when it came to police staffing, when it came to retail theft, etc. He just stayed quiet. And now all of a sudden, oh, I'm running for governor and I'm just going to flood all of my communications with the public about how I'm the guy to handle public safety. It just doesn't come across as sincere. And, you know, I wish the media would push a little back a little bit more about this narrative, because there's so many easy ways to challenge Bob on some of the things that he's saying. You know, the retail theft task force that he's all over the media bragging about. When we had all the looting and rioting in Seattle and Bellevue and elsewhere in 2020, he didn't say anything about the devastation that that had on retail. You know, and even in Seattle, you look at how many businesses are boarded up. He didn't say anything about it until like a year and a half, 2 years later, when he's like, when it was, you know, crisis levels. And he's like, I'm launching a retail theft task force. Okay. And then he talks about, oh, we have the lowest number of police officers per capita of any state in the nation, as if he has nothing to do with that. And his party and their ideology and their not only lack of refusal to support law enforcement, unless it's convenient for them, but also he's been prosecuting police. He's 0-for-4 in police prosecutions. Bob, we talked about this on the show last week. Don't you listen, Bob? Nobody's going to want to be a police officer in the state of Washington if you're the governor. I can promise you that. I don't know that there's any amount of money that you can offer them in some sort of bonus to try to incentivize people who are worried about the political climate here and worried about getting thrown in jail because you want to score another, like, point with the far left. I don't know if there's any amount of money that can buy their willingness to work for you and to work in a state that you're in charge of. But anyway, speaking of the media, so the Washington State Standard, fairly new news publication, they do some stuff that's fine. I think that Jerry Kornfield's pretty good. He writes for the Standard. But this one, I just, again, it's a really missed opportunity to realize as the media that we don't have to be passive when it comes to politicians and when it comes to calling politicians out for their failures. Now, I don't want other members of the media to act like me. People are always like, Brandi, you're not a journalist. I'm not a journalist anymore. Now, I do some journalism, sure, but I'm a political commentator. I give my opinion. I don't expect that. I don't expect my level of pushback on Bob Ferguson to be the level of pushback that the mainstream, what is supposed to be fair and balanced media, does. But there's a difference between what I do and being, which I think when I was in the media, I was this person, not feeling like you have to be passive in your critiques and your criticism. You don't have to do that. You can call a spade, even if you're not an opinion journalist or a commentator. So anyway, this is a story from the Washington State Standard. The headline, Man in the Middle. Ferguson tries to strike a balance on policing. Central to a campaign plan he's rolled out on public safety in this year's governor's race is hiring more state and local law enforcement officers. Will it be enough to staunch criticism from Republicans? And will members of his party go along? And I'll read a little bit more from this article, but it's interesting. So they're painting him in this headline and in their reporting as someone who's moderate. I mean, that's what that speaks to me. It's like, oh, he's in the middle. He's between Republicans and the far left on public safety, which I don't think is accurate. So it says, Ferguson thinks he has an edge on public safety, pointing to his office's work during the past 12 years on issues like combating retail theft, clearing out the state's rape test kit backlog, locking up sex offenders, and winning over $1 billion in opioid industry legal settlements. I mean, the fact that he thinks he has an upper edge, an edge on public safety is just laughable. But it goes on to say, Republicans in the legislature, meanwhile, also contend the state has become less safe under Democrats, who've controlled both chambers of the legislature and the governor's office for about 6 years. Here's the thing. Republicans don't just contend that. You're putting it out there as if it's some accusation from Republicans that's unsubstantiated, and it's not. Everyone right, left, and center, and the numbers bear out that we are less safe. And we do live in a state that has had universal one-party control for at least 8 years, much of the last 20 years, and a Democrat in the governor's office for more than 40 years. So you don't have to attribute that to Republicans. You can go and do your own research and show just how bad crime, you know, the situation that we're in with drug overdoses, etc. It says Ferguson, in an interview on Friday, swerved around questions about whether his party is weak on public safety heading into the 2024 elections. Of course he did. Quote, "I'll let others talk about what they think in terms of the party," he said. "I'm focused on my record." And he shrugged off Reichert. Quote, "I look forward to a debate with Dave Reichert on public safety. I look forward to that." Well, is that a commitment to debate Dave Reichert? I sure hope so. And if you want to have a public safety specific debate on Dave Reichert, oh my gosh, I'm sure Dave is like, let's do it tomorrow. That would be absolutely amazing. It's just kind of a stunning, again, do you guys see what I'm saying about the passivity versus, you know, attributing criticisms to Bob to Republicans? The media doesn't have to do that. I don't know why they believe that they do. You look at the numbers on skyrocketing crime, the numbers on homelessness, for instance, which is a public safety issue, the number on drug overdoses, which is a public safety issue. I mean, what's happening on our roadways, a bit of which we'll talk about coming up, the crazy spike in juvenile crime, which we'll also touch on coming up. Renton said last week there have been a 900% increase in armed gas station robberies there involving juveniles. All of that happened. It's convenient for Bob to say, oh, well, I'm not going to comment on what people think of the party. You're part of the party. You're running to lead the party. You're running to be the party's standard bearer. So if you don't agree with some of the things your party has done in Olympia on public safety, you need to say so. And the media needs to hold you accountable for that. You know, on this King 5 reporting last week, there was this throwaway line at the end where it said, Bob Ferguson says he didn't support rolling back police pursuits in 2021. I've never heard that until just now. Nicole, and you reached out to the Attorney General's office?
I sent an email.
So yeah, and we haven't heard, because we basically said, if Bob has said before right now that he didn't support what his party did in 2021 to make it more difficult for police to pursue violent suspects, give us an example of that. Like, I could be wrong. I don't see everything. I don't see every tweet. I don't see every press release, whatever it is. We just want to know. Because it's mighty convenient that now he's saying, oh, I didn't support that. Now that an initiative has been passed under intense public pressure to put police pursuits back closer to how they were pre-2021. So this is the kind of stuff that, like, the media really has to do its job here. And I think there are some who are up to the task. I think some of it is bias. I think some of it is a lack of institutional knowledge. I think some of it is a misunderstanding about what it means to be fair and balanced. But I mean, we can't on an island, you know, hold Bob Ferguson accountable for his public safety failures. So it's just really disingenuous to me, but he's clearly concerned about it. This is what he's focusing on. So, I mean, for every tweet he sends out claiming that he's some champion of public safety, we got to send out 100 more saying he's not, because that's the truth. All right, let's talk about misinformation specifically. So there's misinformation and disinformation. Disinformation is intentionally misleading. Some of that can be by foreign bad actors for something, trying to get information that's going to, you know, cause unrest in the United States, create problems. So there's disinformation and misinformation. I want to talk about misinformation because misinformation can be something that you put out there that you don't necessarily know to be false, but you've shared it. It could also be, you know, a news story. I'll use the Hunter Biden laptop story, which I think was the New York Post that had initially put that out. And then it got completely squashed by social media. People weren't even allowed to share it. But at the time, you know, Twitter would have deemed sharing that news story as sharing misinformation. And you might have thought, oh, a legitimate news story, which it turned out to be. We'll talk about that coming up. But 60 Minutes did this whole report on misinformation and basically what responsibility, what kind of moral obligation social media platforms like X have to try to rein in the spread of misinformation on their sites. And who exactly is responsible for doing that? Who gets to determine what misinformation is? So here is the headline, Supreme Court grapples with online First Amendment rights as social media teems with misinformation. And it lays out this report as follows. As big tech firms wrestle with how to keep false and harmful information off their social networks, the Supreme Court is wrestling with whether platforms like Facebook and Twitter, now called X, have the right to decide what users can say on their sites. The dispute centers on a pair of laws passed in the red states of Florida and Texas over the question of First Amendment rights on the internet. The Supreme Court is considering whether the platforms are like newspapers, which have free speech rights to make their own editorial decisions, or if they're more like telephone companies that merely transmit everyone's speech. If the laws are upheld, the platforms could be forced to carry hate speech and false medical information, the very content most big tech companies have spent years trying to remove through teams of content moderators. But in the process, conservatives claim that the companies have engaged in a conspiracy to suppress their speech. I had to laugh at kind of one of the overarching takeaway. I'm going to play a couple clips from the 60 Minutes report, but I had to laugh at kind of one of their overarching takeaways or the relevancy of doing this story now. 60 Minutes posted on Twitter with a link to their report. It said, after Elon Musk took over X, most fact checkers were fired. The site is now rife with trash talk and lies. Quote, the toothpaste is out of the tube, says Daryl West of the Brookings Institution. But that struck me. It said the site is now rife with trash talk and lies. What Twitter had you been using all those years? I have never been on a Twitter that wasn't rife with trash talk and lies. I mean, the trash talk thing particularly so. I'm like, do you really think it's only Elon Musk's Twitter that's rife with trash talk? And it's not just X. You go to Facebook, you go to Instagram, it doesn't matter what it is. People suck. It's rife with trash talk. They say terrible things. So it's just this weird umbrella. It's like, you know that Twitter has never been this perfect institution where people are only putting out verified facts from verified sources and they never say anything mean about anyone? That's just not realistic. I would love that utopia, but that isn't what it was pre-Elon Musk anyway. So anyway, it is true that Elon Musk dwindled the staff at Twitter X and basically said that he was going to allow more kinds of speech, that he believes in, you know, being a free speech absolutist. Some people would contend that he has shown otherwise. But it is clear that under Elon Musk, X isn't cracking down on as much speech. So that brings in a University of Washington professor named Kate Starbird. And you might have heard of her before because she was at the center of controversy after 2020 because essentially she was part of a misinformation research group created ahead of the 2020 election that their job, you know, at the University of Washington and in this group was to, you know, flag misinformation and disinformation and do research into how it was spreading, who it was spreading, and all of this stuff. And also, they were making an effort when they found something they deemed misinformation to alert social media companies to it. And Kate Starbird tells 60 Minutes that sometimes the social media companies, oftentimes, they wouldn't listen.
Kate Starbird says the social media platforms also often ignored the researchers' suggestions.
The statistics I've seen are just for the Twitter platform, but my understanding is that they responded to about 30% of the things that we sent them. And I think on the majority of those, they put labels.
But just a third?
But just a third, yeah.
And do you suspect that Facebook was the same?
Oh,
and
yeah.
Yeah, so they responded to 30% of the notes that we sent them. That's 100% more than they're obligated to respond to. You know, you have, and I'll get into sort of the concerns with having a UW group of researchers and Kate Starbird be the ones who believe that they should be able to dictate, you know, what is misinformation and that, I don't know, these social media companies just need to jump. Like the White House thinks that Twitter just needs to jump when they say jump and send an email saying there's concerning information out there. 60 Minutes presented an opposing view from Republican Congressman Jim Jordan.
Congressman Jordan argues that the tech companies shouldn't remove most of what they call misinformation.
I think you let the American people respect the American people, their common sense, to figure out what's accurate, what isn't.
Well, what about this idea that the 2020 election was stolen? You think that these companies should allow people to say that, and individuals can make up their own mind, and that there should be...
I think the American people are smart. Look, I've not said that. What I've said is there were concerns about the 2020 election. I think Americans agree with that.
No, they don't.
You don't think they think there were concerns with the 2020 election?
Most people don't question the result. That's all I'm saying. They don't question whether Biden won or not. Right. Most people don't question the outcome.
Right.
Yeah, but the line of question there suggests that because most people don't believe something, that people who do believe it shouldn't be able to say it. And it kind of freaks me out that a journalist like Leslie Stahl is almost seeming to suggest that. And, you know, he even says, like, he says there's some nuance between believing the election was stolen, which I certainly do not, and being able to talk openly on social media about problems or concerns you have about an election, any election. So there's a couple things here. I mean, and I'll get to our daily subscriber poll in a moment because I asked you guys, you know, what responsibility social media companies have to regulate misinformation. So first, let me be clear. I think there's a ton of misinformation and disinformation on social media and more by the day. I do believe that. But part of that's because of like AI. I do think there should be an obligation because you can, there's scanning software where you can figure out if a video was made with AI, if it was manipulated or whatever. It would be helpful, I think, for a lot of people as AI technology improves to have it scanned and marked as AI. I'm not saying you have to take it down, depending on what it is, but I think that's one thing that social media companies could do in this crazy, ever-changing world we're in to help people decipher between real and fake. Because honestly, some of these AI videos and photos, a very, very intelligent person could fall for them. I mean, there is a lot of them are really good. And so I think that expecting someone to navigate and determine for themselves whether AI is fake or not is not realistic. But the issue with regulating misinformation really comes down to this. Who gets to decide what misinformation is? I mean, if I had to choose, right, in the context of the options, do I want it to be Kate Starbird, who has a long history of donating to Democratic candidates and is a UW professor, seemingly unbiased? No, I don't. I don't think it should be a UW professor or a, you know, team tasked with a misinformation, you know, identification. I don't think that's it. I also definitely don't think it's the government. And if anybody believes the government is the one that should be involved in deciding what's in misinformation and disinformation and what social media companies, private entities should have to take down or put up, that's ridiculous. That's terrifying. I mean, we know, you know, the Twitter files that you had members of the White House who were actively reaching out to Twitter and asking them to take stuff down. Now, I guess in this realm, if I thought it was somebody's responsibility, it would have to be the social media companies to determine for themselves what speech they are going to allow on their platforms or not. But we've already seen that that has been incredibly problematic. You know, the 60 Minutes report, it suggested that Republicans are responsible for the vast majority of misinformation that's spread out there. And I don't know if that's true or not. But what I do know is yesterday's conspiracy theory is today's headline news. How many times have we said that? We've seen it a million times. How many vaccine-related things and COVID narratives were marked as misinformation on social media that later turned out to be true and are now widely accepted? The Hunter Biden laptop story that I mentioned earlier with the New York Post, it was thwarted so much that you couldn't even send a link to that story privately in a DM to a friend on Twitter. And then it turned out to be true. So you have, I think everyone has a bias, right? Whether it's the social media company, the government and who's in power of the government, or a UW researcher like Kate Starbird, everybody has a bias. And so trying to navigate misinformation and take stuff down and decide it on some grand scale is just rife with problems. So yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to individual responsibility to try to figure out is what I'm reading and looking at from a reliable source and a reliable person. I don't know what other way to go about it. So I asked you guys in our daily subscriber poll, do social media companies have a moral obligation to limit the spread of misinformation on their sites? Most of you are saying no, although there are some detractors. Daniel says, limitations that do not fall under the realm of being illegal would be a form of media curation, of which these social media companies do remain platforms, but instead they are publishers. They can't pick and choose which one they are when it's convenient. They need to stay in a lane. You know, and I'll say something about that. I'm actually going to talk about this on the show tomorrow. Nicole, remind me. Instagram has done this thing where right now, if you have an Instagram account, you've automatically been opted in to something that limits political posts. They just added it. And if you go to your settings right now, in fact, let me just do this really quick. You go to your settings right now. And I saw this. I was like, that's crazy. Because we do political posts. And we rely on Instagram for revenue, for our views and you know, sending people to our page and all this stuff. So it's, if you go to your Instagram, sorry, I just want to do this. And we can talk more about it on the show.
Preferences.
Content. Thank you. And content you preferences.
Click political content.
Yeah. Content. So settings, content document. Preferences. And then it says political content. And this is new. And if you go to it and you haven't changed it yet, the selection that says limit political content, oh, now they've updated a little bit from people you don't know. Because it didn't say that before. It just said limit political content, and it had a, it was selected. So yours will be selected. And then it says you can opt in to don't limit political content. The fact that Instagram would automatically assume every Instagram user would be better off if political content was limited is, in my mind, insane. And you look at all the other trash on Instagram. I mean, makeup videos and whatever it is and people's workout stuff and just like just garbage content. So you're cool with all that. And that's not like brain mind melting. But when it comes to political content, which I would argue would include us, right? Yeah. It would include us. It would hurt our reach. I would hope that they would also then limit mainstream media talking about politics, which I doubt.
I hope don't limit lucky posts.
I know. What about my posts about my dog, you know? So it's interesting because when they do stuff like that, I'm like, why would you not at least alert your users to say, hey, we've had this new feature. If we're in an election year, if you don't want to see politics inundating your feed, then you can make that decision. That's building trust with users that you're not just going to shut them off to things they might be interested in, or that you're not biased in the way that you choose what's in their feed, for instance. More answers. Kathleen says, the question assumes that social media is guided by morals and not the whims of society. Moral judgment is balanced. Jenny C says, absolutely not. Who are they to determine what's accurate or not? Seems to me that should be left up to the reader to do their own due diligence to their satisfaction. Let me see. I'll do one more. Chris says, misinformation today is tomorrow's spoiler alert. And that's the thing. And one of the other ways I would buy into this a little bit more is if they would come back and apologize for things they flagged as misinformation that were not, in fact, misinformation. You know, I've felt that way about the pandemic. If they came back and said, hey, you know, this was wrong, we apologize, we took this action we shouldn't have. It's the same with a journalist. That's how you build trust. You apologize for mistakes. You acknowledge your errors. You correct your errors. And you move forward. And that's how people trust you. Because they know that you're not going to do something, you know, that's misguided and just sweep it under the rug. So it's an interesting conversation. I don't have the perfect answer to it. The AI thing, I think, is a must. We need to figure out how to let people know that something is an AI-generated video or image. Because that stuff is tough. I mean, I love looking at architecture posts on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And some of them, I'm like, wait, how is that possible? And then I look and it's like, everybody's like, this is AI, this is AI. And it's annoying. And so I unfollow any account that's using AI images. Just because it's annoying to me, especially with stuff like that. So anyway, interesting stuff.
People are, you know, arguing 2 + 2 = 4. So I think that, you know, something, the world is not round. Maybe we have proof of that, so maybe you can put that as misinformation. But
it's also all like these people know that.
Even the election was stolen. You cannot prove that without a doubt. You can believe it or not believe it. You cannot prove it at this point.
I guess beyond a, you know, shadow of a doubt. Right.
So I just think it's hard to, I mean, that's where I would draw the line is, right. Here's proof. Like, Holocaust happened. Holocaust didn't happen. Like, those are things are very clear, yeah. Right?
Well, these are also coming from, the people who complain the most about this are people who are trying to convince us that men can have babies.
Right. Men so can it's have like, babies dude, and 2 + 2
like,
is racist.
Do not preach to me about misinformation and disinformation. Mm-hmm. And so that's it. It does come down to bias. And, you know, Jim Jordan on 60 Minutes, you know, the left is just trying to eviscerate him online about his belief that people can kind of decide for themselves or whatever it is. But, you know, he's right in believing that this has disproportionately been, you know, targeted toward conservatives and Republicans. And there's many, many examples. And I'm not saying that conservatives and Republicans don't put out misinformation. They absolutely do. But the left does as well. They're not criticized for it as much. And they're certainly not policed as much.
And some of
those big lies, misinformation from the left is like They want to have it be this like widely accepted thing. Like, mm-hmm. Oh no, it's perfectly fine for us to say that men can have children, but no, it's not fine for you to question like an election.
Right. Where are we? Because if we believed absolutely everything that came out of the government without question, nobody could question it. What country would we be in?
Exactly.
North Korea.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. I mean, I get fooled by misinformation sometimes. There's a lot of it. There's accounts that pop up on my ex, and I'm like, I don't even know who this person is. There's certain accounts that you'll be like, have you seen this? And I'm like, who is this person? We have to go dig in. We can't find anywhere else. So anyway,
thank goodness for people that question what's given to us as fact, because
I know
it's not always fact.
100% conspiracies. I am more apt to believe a conspiracy than ever before.
I know.
Oh my God. It's so true though. Any conspiracy that comes across my thing, I would, 5 years ago, Brandy, just living in her little safe shell, would be like, stop it.
I have a sibling.
Stop talking about that. And now I'm like, that could be.
Yep.
I'm not gonna wholeheartedly accept it, but I'm also not gonna dismiss it because I've been fool me once, you know?
I know. I have a sibling that's very into conspiracy theory, and it used to be like, maybe. But now I'm like, okay, what do you need me to do?
Yeah.
Like, what should I do to prepare just in case?
Exactly. So all right, coming up next, we're going to talk about an update on that crash that killed 4 people, including 3 kids. Well, the teen who is suspected in the crash has a really disturbing history. So we'll read through some of the court documents. First, I've been encouraging you all to take the First Mark Challenge. Set aside an hour, a week from now, a couple weeks from now, whenever you have time, and schedule time with First Mark Insurance, firstmarkinsurance.com, to take the First Mark Challenge. Here's what that entails. You come to them with your current insurance. Then you talk to them about your insurance needs. Maybe you need better insurance, different insurance. Maybe you just bought a house or something. Maybe you want a bundle. Maybe you need to save money. They go out, they shop the market for you. They come back and they make recommendations. Dave Taylor is the CEO of First Mark.
I really want to encourage folks, don't try to navigate this current market by yourself. Mm-hmm. I believe you need to get with a broker. Okay, obviously I'd love them to come to First Mark, but at a minimum they need to be with a broker that works with numerous carriers that can give them the advice they need and really help them navigate this right now, because it's complicated.
It is complicated, and insurance companies right now, they're kind of feeling the pinch, and so they are being very, very cautious about what new clients they take on, and they're also dropping people like hot potatoes. If you've got some sort of claim you file, you could find yourself in a situation where your insurance carrier has dropped you, and if you're dealing with it on your own, you're having to navigate that situation and find new insurance, and that can be really tough. And the very best part is, did I mention, First Mark Insurance doesn't charge you a dime. So you get a broker on your team in your corner to help you navigate the complex world of insurance, and they don't charge you anything. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you. All right, we are learning new, really disturbing details about the teenager who was driving 112 miles per hour when he crashed into a vehicle, killing 3 children and a woman who was driving. It is part of really a disturbing trend involving violence and youth. This segment is brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. And I know this juvenile crime issue is something that Future 42 has been focusing on quite a bit. Now, we discussed this story last week. So basically, there was, I think the car was on its way, is part of a homeschooling program. So there was a woman driving, her 2 children were in the car, and then there were also 3 children who were part of the homeschooling thing in the car. So they get hit by a vehicle driven by an 18-year-old who was going 112 miles an hour. The woman dies, the 3 of the children die, her 2 children were left in critical condition. And the last update that we got is their conditions are still very, very serious. So new information came out on this teen. His name is Chase. Well, he's 18, but he's an adult. His name is Chase Daniel Jones. He has now been charged by the King County Prosecutor's Office with vehicular homicide, 4 counts, vehicular assault, 2 counts, and reckless driving. I'm going to read some of the details from these court documents. It's just shocking stuff. It says, the driver of the causing vehicle is the defendant, 18-year-old Chase Jones. He was witnessed speeding and weaving around other traffic and using the shared turn lane to pass. His driving has also been captured on videos. Witnesses were alerted to his aggressive driving and excessive speeding in the 40-mile-per-hour posted road. Crash data from his vehicle corroborates the witness accounts. It showed he was speeding through the red light at 112 miles per hour at full throttle without braking. This was an incredibly violent collision with 3 feet of intrusion into the minivan, which was crushed and pushed into 2 other cars before rolling on its side. Immediately killed was Ms. Hudson, the woman who was driving, 13-year-old Matilda Wilcoxon, 12-year-old Eloise Wilcoxon, and 12-year-old Boyd Buster Brown. Found in the crushed wreckage by first responders was the 14-year-old and the 12-year-old who survived. They're both in intensive care still with significant brain bleeds, internal injuries, and broken bones. It goes on to say, and this is the, I think Nicole had said last week that she suspected this a little bit, because there was sort of some, the pictures looked like the car was very new, the car this 18-year-old was driving, that it had dealer plates, that it was a really nice car. So that part of this is now coming into focus. It says the investigation has revealed that the defendant purchased this vehicle, a 2015 Audi A4, a month before this collision. It is the third vehicle he has totaled in a crash involving speed in 11 months. In May, he totaled his car in a similar circumstance, plowing into the rear quarter panel of a car, resulting in massive damage but no injuries. He admitted at the scene that he had a wide open road, so he gave his car some gas. In January of this year, he totaled another vehicle. The other driver complained that he had not seen the defendant due to the defendant's speed. And here's the key. In both those crashes, the defendant's parents were at the crash prior to police. So I think the suspicion here that this had been some entitled 18-year-old seems to be pretty clear. And we criticize this system a lot for juveniles who break the law feeling as if there's no consequences. We criticize, you know, everything from what happens in schools these days, where it's like, oh, you know, you didn't pass, no worries, it's not a big deal, no consequences. You know, you're not passing your grades, you're not succeeding academically or socially, or your behavior is out of line, and you're given all these free passes, like, oh, hey, it's not a big deal, not a big deal. And so then we wonder why juveniles go on to commit crimes and believe that they can just get off with it scot-free. And so we criticize the system, we criticize the government, we criticize schools, and this is an example of, you know, parents needing some criticism as well. I mean, what parent can you, I don't even know a parent who would buy their child 3 new vehicles in the span of a year after they already totaled 2 of them. And look, I don't know this family. I imagine, you know, now they have a situation where their 18-year-old, who's obviously charged as an adult, is going to be facing potentially decades in prison. I'm sure the family's wishing they hadn't bought him another car. And now you have a situation where that teenager who had already shown that they could get away with this kind of behavior without consequence has now taken the lives of 3 kids, potentially 2 more, who are fighting for their lives, and a woman and a mom. So that's horrifying. And it is an example of all around how society is failing these kids. And then it gets to the point, we talked about this before, you let them off the hook, and then they do something so bad, their life's over. Their life is ruined. Either they're going to die from it or they're going to prison and their life is over. So we're not doing juveniles any favors by taking it easy on them, by making excuses for them, by making them believe, rightfully so, that there aren't consequences for bad behavior. And this is an extreme example of that. I will also say, just because I want to note it, there were at least 3 teens shot and killed over the weekend. One of them, a 17-year-old girl, shot and killed in Tacoma. That happened on Saturday night in the Hilltop neighborhood. Just devastating. But again, and you know, Democrats are going to call this gun violence. I get it. I don't know the circumstances around why she was shot or the legality of whether the person had the gun legally, but you already can't use a gun to kill someone. So you can say gun violence, gun control, whatever it is, you already can't use a gun to kill someone. So what we need to do is to try to figure out how we manage the behavior and how we change the trajectory and the behavior of people who are picking up guns as youth, illegally, using them to kill other human beings. And then I just want to mention this one because I imagine that we're going to have more on this. It's very bizarre. So 2 teen boys were found shot to death on the side of I-5 in Seattle, in 2 different locations. So one was found Thursday night. And in reading the stories about this, it sounds like somebody thought it was like somebody hit by a car, right? Because they're on the side of the freeway. And no, police got there and they had been killed by a gunshot wound. And then Friday morning, they get another call to 911 and they found another teen who was dead with a gunshot wound. And what police are saying, they're still investigating the circumstances of this. Both the boys were 16, found on I-5 in Seattle, that they know each other. So they obviously are like, okay, this is clearly related. You've got two 16-year-olds, both shot. And I don't know if they were dumped on the side of I-5 or if they were shot on the side of I-5, and they know each other. So they're investigating that this is obviously related and talking to family members and trying to figure out what happened. So look, you know, I think you can see all of these stories and, well, at least those last two, and talk about, oh, we need to, you know, get guns off the street and whatever it is that are killing our youth. You can have that conversation, but if you're not willing to take a hard look at some of the reasons behind the spike in juvenile crime. I mean, we talked on the show last week in the city of Renton, they've had a 900% increase in juveniles committing armed robberies at gas stations. And huge increases, not quite 900%, but like 300% increases in things like property theft, for instance. And so we need to, as a society, get a hold of this issue. Or you can imagine what the next generation is going to be like. And it starts really with making sure that at their youngest age, these kids are being taught that they have responsibility for their actions, whether it's at home, in a classroom, or whether it's on the roadway when they commit some sort of criminal act. If we're not willing to impress the importance of responsibility on our youth throughout the system, then we're doomed. Horrible stories. That segment was brought to you in partnership with our friends over at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. We've been talking about the state of the real estate market. I know there's a lot of potential home sellers who are just waiting, and home buyers for that matter, hoping that the Fed drops interest rates. We don't know if that's going to happen, but we've been talking to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com about his sort of expectations.
If they stay where they're at right now, I actually think that values will stay closer to where they're at. We'll see lower appreciation. We'll see appreciation, but it'll be modest. But if they start to come back down, well, that's when I think we'll start to see more of the multiple offer situations and the bid ups in home sale prices.
Yeah. So once those interest rates do come down, I mean, the Fed forecast it was going to cut interest rates. It hasn't yet, but it's an election year. I think it's probably pretty likely. That is the time, if you're going to sell your home, to be ready. Absolutely ready. Day one to take advantage of that rush to the market. Wes Jones can get you ready. Sellwithwes.com. Sellwithwes.com. He's going to start by giving you a market analysis for free. You can plug your address in there at sellwithwes.com and use their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. And then he's going to talk to you about all the awesome marketing that they can do to make sure your home looks great when it hits the market. And they can talk to you about their listing boost concierge service if you need some cosmetic updates to your home, but you don't want to pay for them. They can help you pay for them up front. All right. We had another protest. We didn't. There was another protest on Saturday outside the home of that Bellevue squatter, a serial squatter who's been in this house for like 2 years, hasn't paid rent, and now he's being painted as the victim. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. So we already went through, you know, the Seattle landlord situation with Jason Roth, and now we've sort of turned to what's happening in Bellevue with this guy who is a serial squatter. He's done this before, and he's living in a home that is owned by an Indian immigrant who hasn't gotten money from this guy in like 2 years. And it was a story that was first broke by our friend Jonathan Cho and Ari Hoffman. They did something on it for the Post-Millennial. And so all of that led to a lot of community anger on behalf of the landlord. So remember last Saturday, two Saturdays ago, they had a protest outside this guy's house. And it was peaceful, but there was a lot of shouting and the guy was home or whatever it is. And they said, we're going to come back every single Saturday and basically protest this guy until he feels shamed into leaving because they don't know what else to do. It feels like there's no recourse for them. The system is so backed up. Our laws allow for these squatters, which is what they are, to get free attorneys and all of this. So that's the only thing that they can think of is let's just shame him. Let's go outside his house. Let's chant and rant and rave until he's just like, okay, I got to move. Here's a clip from the protest that happened a couple days ago.
No pay, no stay. No pay, no stay. 나가라 사기꾼. 나가라 사기꾼.
At this point, we're trying to call out Dow Constantine, anything in the Housing Authority under Jay Inslee.
This has been going unchecked and seems to be expected as normal by our law and by our leaders.
So the public...
What are you doing?
Shaming.
This guy has been playing with the system.
Continues.
Brought the doggy today again.
Yes, he doesn't support this at all.
So our friend Jonathan Cho also messed up Matt Gilbert in there. Matt Gilbert out protesting, love it. And the dog. Of course the dog's like, no, get out of that house. But anyway, so any reasonable human being can look at what's happening there and be like, that's not right. You can't just squat in someone's house for 2 years. That can't be what our tenant protections are meant to do for people. And all of us can also agree that, hey, sometimes you're going to have families that might fall on hard times, and no landlord wants to kick out someone who's down on their luck, who's been, you know, an otherwise good tenant, who lost a job or something like that, or a family out on the streets in the middle of winter. It's just ridiculous to paint that narrative of evil landlord. What's happening here, what happened to Jason Roth, what's happened elsewhere, is just wrong. It's theft. It's an unlawful taking of someone's property. It's like stealing money out of their pocket. And I don't know why it's treated differently than that. But then, of course, you have the uber progressives who will do anything. Who, by the way, they love a protest as long as police are being assaulted. That's the kind of protest they like. As long as it's a riot and construction trailers are being lit on fire and police precincts are being overtaken and firebombed and police are being assaulted. People like The Stranger and Publicola, they're like, oh, that was a great protest. Show up and peacefully protest a squatter who's been living rent-free in a house for 2 years? They simply cannot have that. So there has been this fascinating campaign from far-left blogs like The Stranger and Publicola to paint these squatters, these thieves, as the victim. And there's been a few of them. So you'll remember Publicola did a story on Jason Roth, where it tried to demolish Jason Roth's story in South Seattle and, you know, act like, oh, the tenant who was there was the true victim of this. And they came after Jason Roth's character. They basically said, oh, he's just a rich, you know, kid from a rich family. Essentially, like, if you're rich, you deserve to have your house taken over by a squatter. Just crazy stuff. And this whole story was meant to prop up the tenant's version of events and make Jason Roth look terrible. So they did that, and then they did this article. You'll probably recall it because we talked about it on the show, the headline, Renter Protections Aren't Driving Out Mom and Pop Landlords. And then it went on to say that using the phrase mom and pop landlords is racist. It literally said, the very phrase mom and pop is fraught. Michelle Thomas, Director of Policy and Advocacy at Washington Low Income Housing Alliance, calls it a racist dog whistle. Quote, I really do think the image it invokes is heterosexual white older couples. And they're trying to say, quote, think about these people and think about who the tenant is and who do you think needs protection. So now we can't even call them mom and pop landlords because that's just a racist dog whistle. I mean, this is the mindset of these people. It's hard to understand, I think, for people who are reasonable, who work hard for what they have, and also people who are middle class, hardworking, who do struggle to pay their bills, but they make it work. You know, they make it work because they're not trying to screw over other people. That's not like their mission in life. So now, shock of the century, Publicola is out with a hit piece about the Bellevue landlord. Basically, I mean, I'll let you guess what some of the key talking points are going to be. Oh, he's wealthy. Is that one of them, Nicole? You've read it. Yeah.
Of course.
He's wealthy. This is it. Oh, let me guess. The squatter's a victim. Down on his luck.
COVID.
Yeah. Oh, COVID. Oh, so let's read from this. Enjoy. It says, Kim has lived at the property with his wife and four children since mid-2022. He says he worked in procurement and contracting until his employer downsized near the end of that year after a national pandemic task force that it had been part of was dissolved. Interesting. Quote, I'm still waiting. So this guy has reached out to these outlets, by the way. I'm still waiting for a delayed settlement from an incomplete contract I was hired to do, he said, leaving him struggling to pay rent. Kim received pandemic rental assistance through the Housing Justice Project, covering his family's rent from October 2022 through May 2023. He hasn't been able to pay since then. And according to a Nextdoor post, he now owes $45,000 in unpaid rent. And he doesn't dispute that. He says, yeah, that sounds about right. Says the rent is actually owned. So here's where it gets weird. They basically try to paint this as okay because the landlord has LLCs and the rent is owed to the LLCs and the landlord is wealthy. So he shouldn't really be too upset by having a $45,000 back payment due. It says the rental is actually owned by a chain of LLCs the last of which lists a person named Gyanjit Singh Jay as its sole governor on the Washington Secretary of State's website. If Saro, that's Jaskaran Saro, is indeed the owner, it's likely that he's named as such in the property's operating agreement, which is not a public document. Goes on to say, these or other subsidiary LLCs own one other rental property, a duplex, and have been party to at least three multi-million dollar property purchase and sales in the past few years. Two of them demo and rebuilds, and one a straight flip. So I'll save you the details. But it's, again, their mindset is, because these people have bought and flipped properties, because at least they have one other rental, because they're not destitute, they somehow need to absorb or allow an adult man who is perfectly capable of finding employment, that they are responsible for letting him live in their property for free. Imagine that mindset. For people who work hard, pay their bills, even when it's difficult, who might fall behind occasionally, but they catch up as soon as they can. People who would never go 2 years without employment, without going out there day in and day out and looking for a job, any job, to try to support their family. People who would never fall back on, I'm just going to use the system to live in this house rent-free and to put my wife and my kids in a situation where now we have protesters outside our house every single weekend. It is, and then of course they went on and they did another article, and now they're attacking Jonathan Cho. So it's like, oh, if we don't like the message, we've got to attack the messenger. And the Publicola is known for this, and the Stranger is known for this. Again, it's funny how they make excuses for the riots and the violence and the vandalism, but oh gosh, peaceful protest outside a squatter's house, we're going to do 7 articles on it and defend them and make them sound like the victim. Yeah, I won't get into all the stuff they talk about Jonathan Cho, but they're digging into his, you know, oh, civil violations or whatever it is, you know, oh, in a crosswalk or whatever, and they're accusing him of a hit and run and all this stuff. And so they don't like that he's raising awareness for what is a legitimate issue, and so they're trying to discredit him. And that is what the far left does. Like, let's just try to ruin someone's life, ruin someone's career, if they are dare pointing out something that is a clear problem, but that doesn't fit our political narrative. It's just really unbelievable. So I don't even know how outlets like that manage to make enough money to stay afloat. There must be a lot of crazy leftists who are like, I'll read that and give you a dollar.
Well, we know there are.
Well, yes, I guess we know we are. So anyway, if you're a landlord out there, you are not the victim. You are evil. You are rich. And if there is someone who is down on their luck, then your property is owed to them. So get used to it. Okay, let's step outside of Washington State briefly, because this is making the rounds. The Mexican president did an interview with 60 Minutes, a lot of 60 Minutes on the show today. Mm-hmm. And it was quite fascinating because first, and I'll play this clip first, he had a list of basically what, you know, the gist of this is, should Mexico be doing more to stop this influx of migrants and asylum seekers or whatever it is? I mean, the answer seems most definitely yes. But the Mexican president is basically saying, oh, we'll help the U.S., but only if they meet our long, long list of demands. Do you not have it, Nicole? Oh, she's like, strip.
Yeah,
strip.
Sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
I'll have
a
second.
I can go to this next one. The correspondent from 60 Minutes talked to him about the drug trafficking issue and some of the fentanyl that's coming up from the southern border. Do you have that one?
The DEA says cartels are mass producing fentanyl. And the U.S. State Department has said that most of it is coming out of Mexico. Are they wrong?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Or rather, they don't have all the information, because fentanyl is also produced in the United States.
The State Department says most of it's coming from Mexico.
Fentanyl is produced in the United States, in Canada, and in Mexico, and the chemical precursors come from Asia. You know why we don't have the drug consumption that you have in the United States? Because we have customs, traditions, and we don't have the problem of the disintegration of the family.
I can't disagree with him there. I can't disagree with him there, although he's obviously trying to act as if Mexico is not the main supplier of the fentanyl that is killing people on our streets. I mean, the ingredients come in from China, it goes to Mexico, and then it's brought up from the southern border. So he's obviously trying to get off the hook on that, which is ridiculous.
I think he's passing the blame around. He's saying, yeah, there might be some our fault, but it's also this place, and this place.
Yeah, but most of it's coming up from Mexico. And he knows that.
For sure.
He knows that. So it's ridiculous.
I'm just saying he's dispersed.
Oh, yeah. He's like, oh, don't blame us. Do you have this next clip? So here is his list of demands, basically extortion of Biden in an election year if Mexico is going to help with this problem.
With the ear of the White House, President Lopez Obrador proposed his fix, that the United States commit $20 billion a year to poor countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, lift sanctions on Venezuela, end the Cuban embargo, and legalize millions of law-abiding Mexicans living in the U.S.
If they don't do the things that you've said need to be done, then what?
The flow of migrants will continue.
Your critics have said what you're doing or what you're asking for to help secure the border is diplomatic blackmail. What do you say?
I'm speaking frankly. We have to say things as they are. And I always say what I feel. I always say what I think.
If they don't do those things, will you continue to help to secure the border?
Yes, because our relationship is very important. It is fundamental.
It is diplomatic blackmail, although the U.S. has put itself in this situation. It's not as if Biden couldn't be doing things to stop these migrants from coming into the country so freely. And so it's like, well, now he sees the failure, right? And he sees the political hot potato that it's come, and he's just trying to take advantage of it because the U.S. is weak. The U.S. looks weak. And it is weak. So he's like, yeah, hey, how about you keep all the millions of people who've come there illegally already? Like, don't send them back to us. We don't want them back, right? And then let's give $20 billion a year to some of the poorer countries in Latin America and the Caribbean so that maybe you won't have so many people coming into our country in Mexico and then moving up to the United States. So this is just a guy who sees a weak country and a weak leader with a big problem in an election year, and he's trying to get what he can get out of it. I kind of don't blame the guy. So if you had a strong leader, you wouldn't even be in a situation to have to be answering to the demands of the president of Mexico to try to stop people from coming into your country. No, you'd stop them from coming into the country. And then it truly would be Mexico's problem. Because all those Central American migrants, the African migrants, the single adult male men from China who come in, well, they'd be stuck right there on the Mexico side of the U.S.-Mexico border. And I guarantee that the president of Mexico would be singing a much different tune and begging the United States to help them out, not making demands. All right, coming up next, we'll get to your questions and comments from the stream. How does that sound today? And then a really fun sanity check for you. God, I love Florida. Can't wait. Can't keep all the Florida stories for Thursday. But first, there is a Know Your Risk seminar coming up with Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital. It's their 2024 Risk Management Strategy live webinar. In fact, it's coming up this Thursday, March 28th at 3:30 p.m. It is completely free to register. You do it online. We know that 2024 has already had ups and downs and weird stuff. It's an election year, global unrest, you know, really ridiculous stock market performances that are really hard to understand, and the media isn't helping with that. So join Bulwark Capital's Zach Abraham for his free 2024 Outlook live webinar, again, this Thursday, March 28th. You can learn how they actively manage every portfolio that they have in their Bulwark risk management strategy and how they always are seeking opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, and give you as much upside as possible. And I think the big takeaway is you can find out whether your retirement is well protected, because that's the big thing. You've worked hard for your retirement. You don't want to leave it to the whims of this insane market that we're in. And Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital can help you understand that. So don't miss the free 2024 Outlook live webinar this Thursday, March 28th. You can register now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Okay, questions and comments from the live stream. Matt Gilbert with a $5 super chat. Bob said he was against police defunding in his head, and if you didn't hear it, that's on you. Yeah, he said all these things in his head. He wrote them down in his journal. Or doesn't he have a little black book of shame? People say he's got a black
book. Oh, he's got
book.
A
it's
list.
Like a it's like a mystery.
Yeah.
He writes it all down, and then he just, you know. B. Larson says, let's push for Mark Mullett. That way everyone could take a deep breath, sigh of relief, no matter who wins, Dave or Mark. I'd be fine with Mark Mullett. If the choice is Bob Ferguson, Mark Mullett, 100%. But given the makeup of the current race, Mark Mullett can't advance past the primary unless there's some sort of huge shakeup that happens. Nightwolf says, Bob has nothing to stand on other than attack his opponent. If he wins, we'll definitely know the rig is in. I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think that he is the front runner just by default, and it is going to be challenging to beat him. And if we don't approach the election understanding that, I think we'll lose. If we don't approach this election understanding the difficult fight that we're in, understanding how much work each and every one of us have to put in, no idle hands, to be able to get Dave across the finish line, then we've lost before we've started. Adorable Deplorable says, it's true, Brandy. One of my friends is planning to quit Washington State Patrol or move if Bob is elected. Yep. On misinformation and the 60 Minutes story, Weisscastle says, just ask Galileo about what most people believed. Rob Jones, you don't get to actively censor speech and claim you aren't responsible for content. Very true. That is true. And that's a trade-off. It's like, okay, we're going to actively censor all this speech, and that must mean that the speech is left, you don't believe needs to be censored, and then people are going to say, hey, do you support this speech? And then they can't be like, oh, it's not us. Matthew Cook with the $5 super chat. Looks like you've had a bit too much to think. Support your local thought police. Julie Hayfin, I have a strict policy of not giving anyone who believes men can get pregnant and call it science any credibility. I can't take them seriously with anything else they say. And yet those pushing the misinformation censoring trend tend to be those same people. Hard pass. Scott Howells, on the Instagram thing, there's also a fact check setting people should adjust as well. It'll reduce what you see. Yeah, and that's like, I don't want Instagram to be the one who's checking my facts. Like, I can do that myself. Thank you very much. And if there's a page or an account that pops up that has political content that I don't like or I don't find interesting or useful, you know what I can do? I can limit them on my timeline. So, like, I can take care of that myself. Thank you. Let me see. Dano, this is exactly why we need to regulate car purchases with background checks or abolish all cars, as it is not the person behind the wheel's fault. I see what you're doing there. I was like, for a second, I was like, what? And then Jason M. asked an important question. How does 18-year-old get insurance?
I know. It's
we should ask Dave Taylor with First Mark.
I think there's always a way, but it's typically
expensive.
Very expensive.
That's what he's saying. It's like you can get it, and you can also get it from one of these lower sort of class insurance companies that are like, you know, charge you a bunch, your insurance isn't great, but at least you're legal. Like, you have just enough to be technically legal on the roadways. All right, let's get to a couple more. Kenneth Rauch. Brandy, I went to the Lincoln Day dinner on Saturday, met and listened to Dave speak. We need him in the governor's office. He loves God, family, country, and community. What an inspirational human being. Yeah, Dave was at the Okanagan County Lincoln Day dinner. I was at the Whatcom County Lincoln Day dinner, and he had a former sheriff of Whatcom County speak on his behalf because he couldn't be in two places at once.
I know you won't probably say it, but you also gave a very good speech in front of Semi Bird.
I did,
and it was a very nice speech that he came up and said hi and gave us hugs afterwards.
Yeah, I, yes.
So thank you for.
Sure. I had, you know, maybe I'll put that speech out there, but I was informed Semi was going to be there. And, you know, I have been attacked quite a bit by Semi Bird supporters online, you know, called a rhino and a socialist and all these things. And, you know, the message that I basically gave to the room was, look, you can't lose sight of the bigger fight. Bob Ferguson is the bigger fight. And, you know, to the extent that I have strayed from that by focusing on Semi Bird and his campaign and whether I think it's realistic, I acknowledge that. And I think that Nicole's telling me my hair looks weird.
No, me. That was me.
Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah, you're on camera. I was like, sometimes Nicole, when she's not on camera and my hair looks weird, she's like, fix it. So yeah, and then I had just a really brief exchange with Semi Bird after the fact. And look, you know, I will support anyone who makes it past the primary against Bob Ferguson.
Yeah.
Anyone. And I will go to war with them against Bob Ferguson because I think that much is at stake.
Yeah.
Let's end here. And speaking of, I got to get out on time because I'm going all the way to Chehalis for a Dave Reichert event. So I'm going to go introduce Dave Reichert at an event. I told Nicole, you don't have to come. I'm trying to make sure Nicole doesn't feel
it's not
obligated.
That I wouldn't want to, but I have work to do and you've got to run.
I do. Old Sub Sailor with a $10 super chat. What's a good email to use to send photos to, as I'm not on social media?
I assume he means appropriate photos.
For us, right? Yes. So just go to undividedpod.com. undividedpod.com, and the contact feature goes to us, and then when you send us an email, Nicole will send you her email. We don't put out our emails out there because, like, yeah. I don't need spam coming to my emails. One time, I'll give it to them. The far left, I had this Proton account.
Yes.
Like a Proton mm-hmm. email account yep. that I put out for tips on social media. And I'll say this is genius. Some far left angry people signed me up for all these, like on all these lists. I was getting emails from like sex websites and Christian Mingle and Farmers Only and like, you know, deals on literally like sex, you know, things, toys. And and it inundated exhausting. That inbox so much that I had to stop using it because it made it useless. So just go to undividedpod.com, mm-hmm. undividedpod.com, and you can contact us through there. Yep. All right, let's get to our closing sanity check, shall we? Things are just uber sane down in Florida. I want to introduce you, if you haven't seen him on social media already, to Sheriff Keith Pearson of Florida's St. Lucia County. Lucy?
He's going to say it.
He's going to say it. I should have asked Miranda. And they are using the art of public shaming to deter crime.
Yeah, I'm St. Lucie County Sheriff Keith Pearson. Franklin Sanders and his juvenile companion thought they were going to come through St. Lucie County with the stolen vehicle, with the Broward Task Force on their tail. Ain't happening. Although this is an M5 and it's super fast, we got the Scat Pack out. Hey, what'd you think? Good? Yeah, no comment. Although this car hit speeds of 160 miles an hour, the Scat Pack took him down. We want to say shout out to the Broward County Sheriff's Office, Osceola County Sheriff's Office, Indian River County Sheriff's Office for making sure we put this bad guy behind bars where he belongs.
The guy's just sitting against the car with his hair over his head. Any comment? No, didn't think so. It's funny. But so that was from February. So then they just posted this one last week with a suspect who was allegedly involved in a hit and run.
I'm St. Lucie County Sheriff Keith Pearson. Earlier today, Elijah thought he's going to drive through St. Lucie County in a stolen vehicle and get into a car crash, working closely with the Florida Highway Patrol, not only on the sea, but on land. Elijah's now in custody. Our message is this to criminals.
Not in St. Lucie.
I love it so much. Honestly, I think that's what it might come down to. So sanity prevails once again in Florida. All right, that has been it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you again to everyone who invited us to their homes in Whatcom County over the weekend. I was just so nice to meet some of you and to sit and chat and just get to see where you live. It's a beautiful, beautiful area. I don't think I've appreciated that quite enough. And thank you to the Silver Reef Casino for taking money from me at the blackjack table. Lesson learned. All right, we'll see you back here on the live show tomorrow at noon. If you've not signed up to support our show already, you can do so at undividedpod.com. Undividedpod.com. It's just $5 a month. And yeah, we'll see you back here at noon tomorrow.